The following is an evening darshan given by His Holiness Jaya Bhataka Swami on September 26, 1989 in Atlanta, Georgia. The class is about the Nectar of Devotion, Chapter 2.
कृष्ण पदारविन्द भजनानन्देन मत्तालिको वन्दे रूप सनातनो रघुयुगो श्रीजीव गोपालको वन्दे रूप सनातनो रघुयुगो श्रीजीव गोपालको.
I offer my respectful obeisance to the six Goswamis, namely Sri Sanatan, Sri Rupa, Sri Raghunath Bhatta, Sri Raghunath Dasa, Sri Jiva, and Gopal Bhatta Goswamis, who are very expert in scrutinizingly studying all the revealed scriptures with the aim of establishing eternal religious principles for the benefit of all human beings. Thus they are honored all over the three worlds, and they are worth taking shelter of because they are absorbed in the mood of the Gopis and are engaged in the transcendent loving service of Radha and Krishna. Page 20, the first stages of devotion. Here is a general description of devotional service given by Sri Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Previously it has been stated that devotional service can be divided into three categories, namely devotional service in practice, devotional service in ecstasy, and devotional service in pure love of God. Now Sri Rupa Goswami proposes to describe devotional service in practice. Going ahead. There are certain prescribed methods for employing our senses and mind in such a way that our dormant consciousness for loving Krishna will be invoked. Can everyone hear? There's no loudspeaker up here, this one. As much as the child with a little practice can begin to walk. One who has no basic walking capacity cannot walk by practice. Similarly, Krishna consciousness cannot be aroused simply by practice. Actually, there is no practice. When we wish to develop our innate capacity for devotional service, there are certain processes which, by our accepting and executing them, will cause the dormant capacity to be invoked. Such practice is called sadhana bhakti. Every living entity under the spell of material energy is held to be in an abnormal condition of madness. In Srimad Bhagavatam it is said, quote, generally this conditioned soul is mad because he is always engaged in activities which are the causes of bondage and suffering, unquote. Spirit soul is in his original condition is joyful, blissful, eternal, and full of knowledge. Only by his implication in material activities has he become miserable, temporary, and full of ignorance. This is due to vikarma. Vikarma means, quote, actions which should not be done, unquote. Therefore, we must practice sadhana bhakti, which means to offer mangal arati, deity worship in the morning, to refrain from certain material activities, to offer obeisances to the spiritual master, and to follow many other rules and regulations which will be discussed here one after another. These practices will help one become cured of madness. As a man's mental disease is cured by the directions of a psychiatrist, so this sadhana bhakti cures the conditioned soul of his madness under the spell of maya, material illusion. Narada Muni mentions this sadhana bhakti in Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th canto, 1st chapter, verse 32. He says there to King Yudhisthira, quote, my dear king, one has to fix his mind on Krishna by any means. That is called Krishna consciousness. It is the duty of the acharya, the spiritual master, to find the ways and means for his disciple to fix his mind on Krishna. That is the beginning of sadhana bhakti. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us an authorized program for this purpose, centered around the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. This chanting has so much power that it immediately attaches one to Krishna. That is the beginning of sadhana bhakti. Somehow or other, one has to fix his mind on Krishna. The great Saint Ambarisha Maharaj, although a responsible king, fixed his mind on Krishna, and similarly, anyone who tries to fix his mind in this way will very rapidly make progress in successfully reviving his original Krishna consciousness. Now this sadhana bhakti or practice of devotional service may also be divided into two parts. The first part is called service according to regulative principles. One has to follow these different regulative principles by the order of the spiritual master or on the strength of authoritative scriptures, and there can be no question of refusal. That is called vaidhi or regulative. One has to do it without argument. Another part of sadhana bhakti is called raganuga. Raganuga refers to the point at which by following the regulative principles, one becomes a little more attached to Krishna and executes devotional service out of natural love. For example, a person engaged in devotional service may be ordered to rise early in the morning and offer arati, which is a form of deity worship. In the beginning, by the order of his spiritual master, one rises early in the morning and offers arati, but then he develops real attachment. When he gets this attachment, he automatically tries to decorate the deity and prepare different kinds of dresses and thinks of different plans to execute his devotional service nicely. Although it is within the category of practice, this offering of loving service is spontaneous. So the practice of devotional service, sadhana bhakti, can be divided into two parts, namely regulative and spontaneous. Rupa Goswami defines the first part of devotional service or vaidhi bhakti as follows. Quote, when there's no attachment or spontaneous loving service to the Lord, and when one is engaged in the service of the Lord simply out of obedience to the order of the spiritual master or in pursuance of the scriptures, such obligatory service is called vaidhi bhakti, unquote. These principles of vaidhi bhakti are also described in Srimad Bhagavatam, 2nd canto, 1st chapter, verse 5, where Sukadeva Goswami instructs the dying Maharaj Parikshit as to his course of action. Maharaj Parikshit met Sukadeva Goswami just a week before his death, and the king was perplexed as to what should be done before he was to pass on. Many other sages also arrived there, but no one could give him the proper direction. Sukadeva Goswami, however, gave this direction to him as follows, quote, dear king, if you want to be fearless in meeting your death next week, for actually everyone is afraid at the point of death, then you must immediately begin the process of hearing and chanting and remembering God, unquote. If one can chant and hear Hare Krishna and always remember Lord Krishna, then he is sure to become fearless of death, which may come at any moment. In the statements of Sukadeva Goswami, it is said that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Krishna. Therefore, Sukadeva recommends that one should hear about Krishna. He does not recommend that one hear and chant about the demigods. The Mayavadis, impersonalists, say that one may chant any name, either that of Krishna or those of the demigods, and the result will be the same. But actually, this is not a fact. According to the authorized version of Srimad Bhagavatam, one has to hear and chant about Vishnu, Krishna, only. So Sukadeva Goswami has recommended to Parikshit Maharaj that in order to be fearless of death, one has to hear and chant and remember the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, by all means. He also mentions that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is Sarvatma. Sarvatma means the Supersoul of everyone. Krishna is also mentioned as Iswara, the Supreme Controller who is situated in everyone's heart. Therefore, if some way or other we become attached to Krishna, he will make us free from all danger. In the Bhagavad Gita, it is said that anyone who becomes a devotee of the Lord is never vanquished. Others, however, are always vanquished. Vanquished means that after getting this human form of life, a person does not come out of the entanglement of birth and death, and thus misses his golden opportunity. Such a person does not know where he is going, is being thrown by the laws of nature. Suppose one does not develop Krishna consciousness in this human form of life, he'll be thrown into the cycle of birth and death involving 8,400,000 species of life, and his spiritual identity will remain lost. One does not know whether he is going to be a plant, or a beast, or a bird, or something like that, because there are so many species of life. The recommendation of Rupa Goswami for reviving our original Krishna consciousness is that somehow or other we should apply our minds to Krishna very seriously, and thus also become fearless of death. After death, we do not know our destination because we are completely under the control of the laws of nature. Only Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, is controller over the laws of nature. Therefore, if we take shelter of Krishna seriously, there will be no fear of being thrown back into the cycle of so many species of life. A sincere devotee will surely be transferred to the abode of Krishna, as affirmed in Bhagavad Gita. In the Padma Purana, also the same process is advised. There it is said that one should always remember Lord Vishnu. This is called dhyana, or meditation, always remembering Krishna. It is said that one has to meditate with his mind fixed upon Vishnu. Padma Purana recommends that one always fix his mind in the form of Vishnu by meditation and not forget him at any moment. And this state of consciousness is called samadhi, or trance. The last paragraph we'll read tonight. We should always try to mold the activities of our lives in such a way that we constantly remember Vishnu or Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That is Krishna consciousness. Whether one concentrates his mind in the four-handed form of Vishnu or on the form of two-handed Krishna, it is the same. The Padma Purana recommends somehow or other always think of Vishnu without forgetting him under any circumstances. Actually, this is the most basic of all regulative principles. For when there is an order from a superior about doing something, there is simultaneously a prohibition. When the order is that one should always remember Krishna, the prohibition is that one should never forget him. Within this simple order and prohibition, all regulative principles are found complete. Vande Rupa Sanatana Raghuyano Si Jiva Gopala Go Pagakaruti Vishnu Nangai Re Giringati Patana Vande Jiva Gopala Go. So tonight was announced as the Ishtagoshti. Ishtagoshti is when it's kind of a free-for-all. That all those funny questions that keep coming up in the Bhagavatam class are supposed to be asked here can be asked. And we wanted to have 6 to 7, but we got late start. But I don't think it would be the end of the world if you went till 8, strictly end of the 8. I never got to take a rest at 8:30 yet. That's, you could do that via first anyway. So if anyone has any questions? Balabhadra Bhattacharya Das Adhikari is kicking off the ball.
Sometimes devotees have difficulty in adjusting in their mind the conception of following the instructions of the spiritual master. When they find themselves having to follow the instructions of other authorities, presidents, GDC, or temple commanders, or senior leaders. So how can they help? What instruction can you give to help people understand their circumstances? How, by following, you know, another authority or another personality is the same as following the spiritual master? Of course, in some instances it may not be the same, since if someone may be given a wrong instruction, so how should they do in that circumstance?
Well, there's different categories of instructions. There's being given service. Srila Prabhupada instituted the system that temple presidents are, in a kind of broader sense, the GBCs, although they don't often have a direct contact so much with the devotees in terms of giving out services, although sometimes they do. Prabhupada instituted that they would be giving out the services for the devotees, and many times devotees would want to come to see Prabhupada, but if they wanted to discuss about philosophy, his door was always open. In fact, if someone heard some philosophy from another temple, from a president or GBC or any leader, and had some doubt, they could always come and ask Prabhupada about the philosophy, and then Srila Prabhupada would give the philosophical answer. But if somebody came and wanted to discuss about his service, then immediately Prabhupada would cut him off and say that, I can't deal with your service. You have to talk to your temple president. If he can't deal with it, talk to the GBC, like that. The maximum he would deal with is transferring somebody from one of, somebody said, I can't work with this authority, I want a new authority. Then he would transfer the devotee from one temple or one authority to another. But if a person was a chronic, you know, change, I remember that one devotee, won't mention his name to protect the innocent. He got a letter from Srila Prabhupada said that here again you'd like to change the temple. But this is about, you know, 10th time or something, or 8th time, whatever. So every temple you go to, you say the authority is not good, temple's not good, you don't want to be there. So since every temple you go to, you have the same problem, maybe you should look to yourself. That maybe you have a problem in your own consciousness. Because how can every temple and every authority be bad? You know, in other words, alright, maybe once, some personality conflict, twice, you know, but like, he was like a karmic. And so then the devotee started to introspect and find that actually he didn't have a very good attitude. And it was his attitude which was like a stumbling block in him integrating in any temple. It wasn't really changing the temple to make any difference. So in that regard, the point is that a temple president can't give an instruction that goes against sadhu, shastra, and guru. He's supposed to give service. Prabhupada hoped that devotees would cooperate and try to do the service. Now, someone had a real problem doing a particular service. They kind of go up the chain of command and try to say, well, look, I'm having difficulty in doing this service. I'd like to... And then, in some cases, Prabhupada would intervene and say, like, let the devotee do some other service. But even in my case, I was a temple president and then I abdicated the temple presidentship for practical reasons and offered it to Jagadish Prabhu. At that time he was married to Lakshmi in Toronto, but then I became the treasurer. And I found that being the treasurer after being a president for 2 years was kind of like boring to me. So I wrote to Prabhupada because it was beyond the scope of... Of course, that time there were no GBCs, so I had to write to Prabhupada. But imagine that later down the road I would have had to write to the GBC member. I wrote to Prabhupada and said that I feel bored. I don't feel engaged. But if you want me to do this service, I'm prepared to continue doing it. But if there's another service you'd rather have me do, I would be prepared to do that also. Then he wrote back and said, go to India. See, but my desire was to try to increase my service. I successfully managed the temple, so to being a treasurer wasn't really, it's kind of like, I could do it with my eyes closed. And then Prabhupada gave me more than I could, like, chew. So he read in the verse about marriage, Bhagavatam 7th canto, how if one has that consciousness that I'm serving the Supreme Personality of Godhead through the Guru, through my husband, through my master, then that way they can be Krishna conscious. At the temple president says, go and rob a bank, something which is completely against our ISKCON laws, because we're not supposed to break any criminal laws. It says to do something which is against our principles, then obviously it'd be something that we'd refuse to do and we would report it to the GBC member. So the temple president said, please go out and sankirtan, or please go out and harinam, or please wash the dishes. No, I won't do it. Then, what in the temple? There has to be some kind of a discipline, otherwise nothing works.
He said that the system that Prabhupada created was to go to the president or the GBC. And now we see that many of the GBC are also gurus. So the system, with Prabhupada being the spiritual master, he would, as far as the service, you said, tell them to deal with the authorities in GBC. Now, one of the GBC is a guru itself. Does that mean that you can still go to your guru because it's a GBC? Or, I mean, is it a principle that if, as far as service and practical management affairs and things like that, you shouldn't go to your spiritual master and you just go to the president?
I thought it was clear, but I can say it in a different way. But the temple president's responsibility specifically is to give service to everyone. Of course, overall, he has a general responsibility to see that everyone is Krishna conscious, attending temple programs. He also has administrative responsibility to see that temple bills are met, mortgage is paid, etc., etc., etc. But in terms of, we were just talking about in relation to the devotees, his responsibility to see that the devotees are Krishna conscious, attending the temple spiritual programs, and are otherwise engaged in devotional service. So a devotee is having difficulty with a particular service, and in discussing with the temple president, the temple president's not able to somehow eradicate their doubts or solve their problem or whatever, then one can go to the local GBC regarding service matters. If it's a, in many places, the local GBC is not necessarily, most places, not necessarily the guru of a local devotee. In some cases, the local GBC may also be a local guru. So there's kind of two functions. If, for instance, say I have a disciple in a place where I'm not the GBC, just in another zone, and they have a problem with their service, that then I would advise them to discuss with the local GBC. If they're having a spiritual problem, if they're having a problem with doubts in the philosophy, with, or they've gone through all the other avenues and somehow they're still in some kind of a unhappy situation, then I would either personally discuss with the local authorities and work out some kind of a program for that disciple. In the case where I'm the GBC somewhere, and one of the devotee having some problem, then in one sense, there's the advantage that it's easier for me to take the devotee and shift from one temple to another, since I'm also an administrative authority over the different temples. On the other hand, it's one less run you can appeal your case to. Come from the president of the GBC. Still, it's the Arya Sankhya law that no guru should take a disciple whimsically or without any reason, unless there's like a severe spiritual crisis, life and death kind of circumstance, that a guru is not supposed to pull a disciple from a temple. That would apply whether it's in your zone or not. If it's in my zone, generally the temples, we work together close enough. If the devotee's having some problem, we work out a trade, or in the long run it kind of equals off. One temple had a devotee had a problem, we bring someone from, say, New Orleans to here. A year down the road, someone here doesn't get along so well, we shift him over to New Orleans or something like that. You know, kind of in the long run, things work out. So I can still all keep an oversee directly. Where the person's not the GBC and the guru, then they have to go through the local authorities, and then the guru is there in case of some problem, he can intercede, he can talk to the local leader. But specifically then he doesn't, his main thing is to deal with the spiritual problems of the devotee, spirit preaching. And it depends, I mean, some, each guru is involved in a different way. I personally know that, you know, like I have a disciple in Finland, you know, a couple, and I regularly talk to the temple president, what service they're doing. They mentioned that, you know, one couple's a like friend of Krishna, they work for a corporation, another one's a Sankirtan, you know, tell me how the Sankirtan is going, Sankirtan pastimes in Finland, things like that. Feeling cold?
No one to go out, it's alright.
Hare Krishna.
Can you sit over here?
What?
You can sit. This is Jean, she comes to the temple right here.
Gina.
Gina.
Did that answer your question? Madhupan is the temple president. What's his... He can get some practical... is this theory, or does this actually work like that? What's...
In Bangalore temple, GBC and Guru is same. So, hardly any problems.
His question was, sometimes there's difficulty in devotees. They listen to the spiritual master, but sometimes it's hard for them to listen to the temple president and the other authorities of the temple. But how can the devotee see that it's actually, if you're following authorities, you're actually following the spiritual master, right?
I thought you asked the question after this. That's a good question. The question's already answered.
Well, that's one. It's interesting. I was reminded how Prabhupada said, some people come and say, Prabhupada, I follow you, but I can't follow anybody else. And then Prabhupada thought, you know, this was like kind of a real burden. Or sometimes he'd be one further and say, well, I accept you, but I don't accept this kind. I don't like organization. Then Prabhupada said, well, this kind is like my body. How then you can't see it really separate from me. It's a preaching, cooperative movement that I made. So you get to a point where, you know, it's like people say, well, I only follow God. So then, in effect, is that I don't follow anybody. So it's a difficulty. We have to avoid creating a kind of personal psychology which is so impractical that it bottlenecks our real effort to serve Krishna and to become Krishna conscious. You guys, any question?
Yeah, generally, like, just in India, they have to listen to the authority other than the guru, then they want to see that the authority is leading a strict spiritual life or maintaining a standard of, let's say, simple living, you know, somehow they have to command respect from the devotees, because ultimately everyone is come for devotional service. So if they are forced or demanded something, then naturally they will revolt. So the leader's responsibility, greatest responsibility, will be to command respect by his own activities, by being very serious in his own activities. And then I see there shouldn't be any difficulty. That's the greatest task for the leader. It's not more than, at least in Bangalore temple, I see that I spend most of my time in seeing that the devotees are taken care of. I feel that sometimes I had a realization that the temple president's job was grossly, it may not, some collectors may think that the temple president is not collecting or not doing something directly, but his main job is more like a cowherd or a shepherd who goes with the sheep, who keeps, they go for, take a sleep. You walk with them, no? That's also a service. If somebody doesn't do that, then they all go astray. But simply he's walking with them, so it may appear that he's not doing anything. But actually his mind has to be there, and it's his attention, he has to sacrifice his attention on all the devotees. So that's a big job. So the devotees will naturally respect the authority when they see that they are giving their attention on the devotees' problems and all those things.
I know. A lot of times people don't realize what it is to be a temple resident. I remember there was one devotee who was always complaining about the temple president and everything. So then GBC made him the temple president. 2 days later, GBC came back about 2 days, or 3 days, and just a few days later came back. And he attacked the GBC, tried to strangle him. He said, "How could you do this to me? Everybody's coming to me. Where's the soul? Where's the this? Where's the..." Everyone's complaining. You know, he was one of the big complainers. So then when he was in the seat, then he had to get it. So then, you know, some people can take it, but it's hard to, you know, can give it. It's hard to take it. He resigned in a very unusual way. We have to save the GBC. Yes?
Excuse me. What happens in the case that the temple president is not acting accordingly to his principles as a leader?
Should we report it to the local GBC?
One should never keep quiet when one sees something. Like if one sees a certain attitude or a certain action,
that... No, we're not talking about attitude. We're talking, you said that if a temple president is not functioning as a properly situated devotee or something. I mean, if it's somebody is breaking the four regular principles, they're grossly negligent in attending spiritual programs or something, this should be reported.
Why should never keep quiet?
Huh?
Why would you keep quiet?
We're trying to help people. If somebody's having a spiritual problem, it should be reported to the local. Now, sometimes someone may not like a person, may not like the way he deals, may not like his attitude, may not like, you know, like some people may be flamboyant people, some are very quiet, some are different types of people. So some people may be, you know, may have a nature which just doesn't really mix with what you... You may not particularly like that nature, or you think a person should be more... A person's idea of what a sadhu is, what a saintly person, may be a little bit different, but that person might not exactly fit into your ideal picture. Like, you wouldn't accept that person as your guru or something. But that doesn't... It may not even fit in that temple. But it doesn't mean that that person should stop doing devotional service or cannot... He may be respected by many people as a leader and may be able to function as a leader at a particular level. Then there's also to some people, there's different places in the world. I know certain places in the world where you put in blind uncles because there's such a shortage of leaders that you put in people as leaders who would make it somewhere else. you know, but like maybe in Africa or in South America or some parts of, mainly that's the biggest problem cases, maybe some parts of Asia, I don't know. You may get a situation where there's just no leaders around. There's no leader capable people. And so sometimes you put in people that maybe they wouldn't put in other places, but then there's just very few people want to work in those places. But if a person gets too far off or is really breaking their principles or something, not making any effort to correct himself, then obviously we can't keep such a person in a position over devotees, because he would make decisions which are not proper.
Aganuga Bhakti.
These are like little dynamics of our society today, the management of disciples and zones and the relationship between God brothers and disciples, between God brothers or the God brothers and GBC. It's I can't figure it out, and I don't have any no understanding of it too much, because it seems like it's kind of like testing or going on with a system which we hope that will Krishna will bless it, and somehow or other continue to go wrong, from what I understand. After seeing that my spiritual master personally resigned from GBC, and to see that there were managers not working with him in certain ideas of how he wanted disciples to be managed, because many disciples were complaining about certain godbrothers appears that were not properly engaging his disciples. So he kind of explained that to us. So it's kind of interesting to see that many GBC members who resigned from management positions, how this kind of continued to go along without their, say, material, their influence over their disciples on a day-to-day basis, such as that before when the spiritual master resided in his zone, he would detect what his disciples can do. Everyone would rally around the guru's desires. For example, you know, many gurus have certain desires or certain responsibilities to Prabhupada. Their disciples would gather together and rally around that particular guru's mission. And that seems to be playing down to the moral in society. So I still find it very complex in some ways, but my question is there are some cases where devotees will complain about an authority that he feels is not getting a fair, fair leadership or a fair guidance in spiritual life.
And hold this in, like, end up in a question.
Yeah. So he may complain, and sometimes a leader may take the position of the guru and say that, well, your spiritual master doesn't want you to do this, your spiritual master doesn't want you to do that. And in other words, rubber stamp the guru's name on a lot of his own ways of being disciples to do certain things. I just want to get your opinion about that.
Well, that's where you can always ask the guru. In fact, what was the book I would just translate it for the GBC? Jiva Goswami. And last year when we made the paper for taking shelter of the guru, there were several books which were used as reference. Where specifically it says that anyone as a Vaishnava or as a Shiksha guru, whatever they say to you, then later on you should check it with your Diksha guru and just confirm it that it's what they're telling is a proper understanding. Because everyone has the responsibility through Krishna to serve to their Diksha guru. And one should just check it when it comes to like some philosophical instruction which you didn't hear before, you're not sure about. So it's not something new. It's something that's been going on for hundreds and possibly thousands of years. Before it was dealing with, say, Shiksha gurus and Vaishnavas. You know, it's like a structure, so that's the title, temple president. But even when there wasn't temple presidents, there were always Vaishnavas, and older Vaishnavas would take the younger Vaishnava over and tell them this and that and the other thing. And as an older Vaishnava, you couldn't just say, you'd listen, you'd have to take it at face value. But then, according to the previous acharyas, take it with a grain of salt, and then check it with your guru and make sure that it's the right idea. Or get from him. If that's the meaning, If we accept a spiritual master, I remember I was sitting in the hospital in Spain, listening to the Nectar of Devotion tapes, and tape number 15, no matter how many times I'd say put on Nectar Devotion tape, they always put in tape number, there's like a whole box, it's in the sound, they'd always put in tape number 15. Even a few times I'd said, you know, I already heard that one. But somehow, they just always put in tape 15. So after a while, I just surrendered. So it must be some instruction I got to hear again. And Prabhupada made a point there that, of course, even though I heard it so many times, I don't know if I can say it exactly. At one point, he said that how we have to accept a guru. And he said, what is... In just very simple words, in fact, I had Prem Bikash's kind of want to write it down in my notebook somewhere. He says that accepting the guru means that you, the person that you can surrender to fully in your service to Krishna, link with Krishna. That's the qualification. You know, people started thinking, but everyone says, how do I know who to accept as my guru? Prabhupada, he just said like one sentence, just the question, who you can surrender to. Fully. Because, and then he went on and explained, because whatever he instructs that you're supposed to do is the final word in your spiritual life. So when someone accepts a guru on that level, accepts a guru, so then whatever instruction he has in the Vaishnavas should clear it. Because then that's the way he's going to continually get the instruction from that guru. We have to learn from the guru whatever he has to teach us.
But with all respect and etiquette, let's take an example. Let's say that Baba Bhagavad here gives an order to me, for example, and I don't feel that it's in line with what you say. And I get back to you and say, well, I know I said Baba Bhagavad, but that's not what my group are. Baba Bhagavad may say, well, that's not true. I also know what Charipad wants. But I'm saying, no, this is what my guru told me. So now it goes back to you, and then you have to communicate with him. And it's like, I'm using my, you know, I can use the guru, and he can use the guru, and we both like, well, I know what Charipad wants, and he knows what Charipad wants, therefore it's not a big friction here. So now...
That's an over-service, generally over-service. It's not something that we should jam up the whole works. If it's over some major thing, like someone's saying to do something which is completely off the wall, or so if it's over some major philosophical deviation, you know, from our... Shastras, okay, maybe it's worth making a stand on principle. Generally, I am seeing many temple presidents that order someone, you must do this, but they preach, they coax, they encourage, they try to encourage a devotee to do a particular service. And that they do, that's part of the job description, trying to encourage someone to do a particular service. They may have idea that this devotee can do that service, but I think that the particular word description of giving an order, you know, you must do this. I don't think devotees are so submissive anymore that it really works. I think it hasn't worked for a long time. Even as a guru, it's hard to order some. We can't discuss with them and find out what they're capable of doing, and then accordingly you give them an instruction based upon what capabilities and possibilities there are. Most temple presidents would be very happy if everybody would just put in a 40 or a 60 or, you know, some particular, even 20, you know, some hours of service every week responsibly for the temple. There's some persons that live in the temple property that don't really pull their weight. And it's kind of a burden for the other devotees and for the whole congregation because, especially in this temple where it's mainly focused on distributing books and they're trying to stay away from any form of fundraising which use the old kind of flim-flam procedures and just collection procedures. You just basically distribute books, so the margin of donations on books is not as much as if you sell hat stickers, candy canes, etc., etc. So they need devotees to go out and distribute books. And certainly distributing books is not something that Prabhupada didn't appreciate. He really appreciated it quite a bit. Satsarupa Maharaj appreciated it. I think everybody appreciates it. But maybe someone is not capable of doing that service. So then they could cook, serve the deities, do some service. Suddenly you get into a situation where in the bottom line, the devotee is doing practically very little service. Because every service is offered, well, this isn't bad. That, you know, as you say, they kind of jam it up, well, my guru said this, or this one said, you know. But ultimately we have to do some service for Krishna. if we want to practice sadhana bhakti, otherwise we're going to be serving maya, we'll be doing karma. So when I am here, occasionally devotees come and we work things out, but quite often I find that the devotees who do have the problems don't really want to sit down together with me and the temple president and work it out, even when they're my disciples. So then one doubts, you know, why not? Why not work it out? Why not try to find a solution? Or sometimes even something is agreed upon, but then subsequently it's not followed. You know, it's practical problems. Some devotees seem to have difficulty really finding a service that they can do, or maybe it's just a question of surrender. Theoretically they'd like to do it, but practically when it comes to doing it, then they're just not able to do it. But we have to get off the kind of mental platform and, you know, whatever service we do for Krishna is like depositing money in the bank. It's like it's spiritually that's giving our deposit into the fixed deposit. Whenever we're spacing out, we're not achieving anything materially or spiritually. There's two sides, you know, there's two extremes. A lot of times there's a lot of false ego that plays into the whole thing. On the other hand, there may be that someone batters around the name of the guru too much when it's really a person's own personal opinion. I mean, I know that happens sometimes. Someone may say, well, I think you should do this. You know? Instead of saying that might not carry enough weight to say, well, I think your guru wants you. Certainly, if you do that too much, it's like calling wolf, right? Pretty soon won't have any weight. And when you really mean it, when you really know that the guru wanted the disciple to do something and you do say it, the person will think, well, he always says that, so how do I know that the guru really wants me to do it? So obviously it wouldn't be a good policy to use it so cheaply, since everyone wants to please their guru. It should only be used when someone really knows that. I mean, I know that even in some cases, not in this temple, but in some cases, you know, people have told, well, I think your guru wants you to marry this person or something like that, or they haven't even consulted with me. So, you know, it can be, definitely it's going to be misused. So, and major decisions like that, which can affect your whole life, and it's good to just check it out and be sure that it's coming from that.
Can someone actually have a, take instructions from a shiksha, without really consulting with the diksha? I mean,
if you have the permission of the diksha guru, if the diksha guru says you can accept whatever he says, like, as what I'm saying, and you have the faith, if you have the faith in that diksha guru, and then you get the permission of your diksha guru, or you're in the situation where your diksha guru is not present, and that person, who's not, like, in the, active in the world, and you can accept a shiksha guru on that level. It's not like a whimsical, well, today I'll use my shiksha guru and tomorrow I'll have this one. It's like searching the doctor that gives you the cure you want, rather than what's really good for you.
You know, Mark, you're just so young and fickle. I mean, 18, 20 years of age, psychologically speaking, we don't seem to know ourselves so well to actually be so committed to a project or to a temple or to... You're so bad with the modes of nature. So it seems like there's a lot to be tolerated with, you know, just being someone who can be a temple president or an authority in someone's lives and is less than probably, you know.
Prabhupada, at least if people can commit for, you know, difficult to make lifelong commitments, at least if devotees can commit for a period of time, 1 year, 2 years, some period of time. And during that time, the point is when we're serving, we should just serve wholeheartedly. Because the question is, like, devotional service is like our opportunity of returning our energy back to Krishna. So the more we can practice with our mind, our intelligence, our body, then that's our connection with Krishna is enhanced. So the service is like just a via media. It's a method, it's a means to achieve the end. Because the means and the end is indifferent. But on the absolute platform, I know even for sannyasis who grihasthas tend to kind of settle down projects eventually. But sannyasis are known, you know, they're traveling mendicants, basically they can travel around. But even Prabhupada would bring all the sannyasis in front of them and say, you have to each commit what service, what project you're going to be with for 1 year. And as a sannyasi, next year you can change. You know, I won't tie you down, you have to stay to a project for your whole life. But at least this year, every year you have to commit. Not that just to change, you know, from 1 minute to the next. See, so what to speak of for brahmacharis or generally grihasthas, generally they stay more committed to a particular project, especially if they had some connection or they became devotees there, or if there's some doing some service. If there's a reason to change, it should be to increase your service. It should be for a positive reason, for our prasanna. In my case, I got a lifelong commitment to my employer, Mukunda Das.
If a person, he continues some service, and if he gets troubled all the time in the service, what do you do? Not only one day, but months, and years after you carry on the service, what do you do?
Well, if he can't solve it with the local president, then he could approach the GBC, his own secretary, can't solve that, discuss with his guru what to do.
How should a devotee react or feel or do about it when he's asked to do a service which he has no taste for it, but he does it as a matter of duty? But he knows he won't be able to do it for a year or 2 years in the long run because he has no taste for it. But he wants to do other services because there's no one else to do this service with him.
He knows there's a need to do a particular service. And he does it because he knows it needs to be done, even though particularly he doesn't like to do that service. Sounds like a surrendered soul. Certainly that helps us to surrender. I was offered so many services, and every service seemed like that, you know, the one that no one else wanted to do, that, you know, wasn't really the one I wanted to do either. And then finally Prabhupada gave me a service, you know, my effort was just like ever-expanding service. So then I wrote to Prabhupada that is something wrong that if you like doing the service that you're given by the Guru? And I felt the other, I felt guilty, you know. I was given, finally got a service I really liked doing. You know, plenty of challenge. I always wanted to challenge something which I could get bored if you just take it. There's nowhere you can expand. Here was a service, I couldn't even see the end. It was like unlimited expansion. So I was feeling guilty that... So then I wrote back, I said, no, that's very fortunate. Yes?
Get off the subject, but...
Now this is open, somehow we're just like stuck in a particular track. You can ask anything.
What do you consider the most important thing in spiritual growth?
Well, that's a very good question. It's a very simple question, but then it... Since it deserves a very good answer. Today we read, before you came, we read a verse and a few pages from the Nectar of Devotion where it discussed about devotional service. And there, the practice of devotional service. And it summed up everything by saying that there's an injunction we should always remember God, remember Krishna, never forget it. That if we do that, then everything else is contained within that. The point is that for spiritual life, we need to be Krishna conscious or God conscious. And to engage ourselves, but to do that, everything is geared, the whole reason within that broad concept, chanting, serving, eating prasadam, is all contained, because through these processes we can always be remembering Krishna. And if we do that, then we don't have to forget Krishna. So that's something which would apply in the beginning of our spiritual life to the end. If we break it down into more details, then there may be different details that would apply for a beginner as compared to someone who is in an intermediate stage or advanced stage. But being conscious of Krishna, that's something which is all for beginning, middle, end, all the time. That's what's missing in the Western world is God consciousness as such. And the consciousness should be an unbroken consciousness which is in a mood of service, a favorable mood, a mood to follow without, then from there grow and become more and more in a loving mood. He said there's different stages. In the beginning you follow a certain practice. He said the practice is like a baby learns how to walk by practicing, but that's because the baby already has the capacity to walk. You couldn't teach a tree how to walk or something. And teach a baby. No, baby has the capacity within. So we have the capacity of loving Krishna. But just in the beginning, to get us like started off, so there's certain practices we follow. And then that develops to a point where it becomes spontaneous. And we develop ecstatic love for Krishna. And then finally that becomes purified, we become liberated, and we have pure love of Krishna. Dina, any question?
Yeah, there's one. I was wondering, you said Sunday that everything that was is in the Bhagavad Gita. I think you said that. I wanted you to tell me if this was in the Bhagavad Gita.
One of our devotees. No, Jesus said, I am the way and the truth and the life, and no one comes to the Father but by me. John 14:6. One of our devotees, Satyaraj Das, has done a lot of inter-Christian, Krishna-conscious studies. Wrote several books, even recently sent me a book from my mother here, of a dialogue he had with... Was that priest? What's the denomination?
Episcopalian
priest.
Heart.
Huh?
His heart.
You can bring it in short. He dealt with this particular verse in the original Hebrew or Greek or whatever it's written in, that Jesus, when he spoke it, like a lot of these things are, into the translation, they're always upgraded to be more modern and more, and so in that modernization, they tend to change a little bit. Here's his most recent publication between Reverend Hart and Stephen Rosen, Satyaraj Das. I haven't had a chance to read it, but I mean, he studies a lot about the Bible. So I did happen to read a previous book he wrote, and there he broke down this particular verse. And there, that when Jesus said, I am the way, that you have to come through me to reach the Father, that in many languages in Asia, including the Hebrew, and in India there's many languages, they have different tenses. So there's like the present tense. Like you say that, you know, if you want to get to New York, you have to go with me now because there's no more flight tonight, there's no, it's like, you know, like now. That when he was speaking, it was speaking in the present tense. If you want to get to the Father, I'm the way. But according to the Vedas, there's a philosophy that the Guru is the means by which the disciple can get to God. So here Jesus is the Guru, he's talking to his disciples, his apostles. He's the person who's preaching at that time, he's the Acharya, he's the spiritual master. He's telling him, you want to get to the Father, you have to go through me. So that's nothing contradicting what's in the Vedas. We would agree that at that time and that place, Jesus was the means for those people to get. But it's not that before Jesus came on the earth there weren't other spiritual masters, or that afterwards that there won't be other spiritual masters, but that the teachings of spiritual masters, in essence, in practical time, place, and circumstance, he had to preach to particular people who had a particular capacity. Like even the apostles approached Jesus and asked him that, you've told us so much about this world, and you talk about the kingdom of your Father. Tell us more about the kingdom of the Father in heaven. And then Jesus replied after a little thinking that even what I tell you about this world, you're not able to understand. How are you going to understand about that world? In other words, apparently Jesus himself felt that his disciples were not capable of understanding all the teachings he had to give them. He didn't know about the kingdom of God. He definitely knew, but he didn't impart that knowledge to them, you know, for his own reasons, that they weren't able to understand. So we have that problem also in many Vedic situations, that sometimes you have different gurus and they have to teach to hunters or to very simple people who are not very philosophical. So they end up giving them very simple teachings, chant the name of God, sit here and meditate, do some basic thing. Or then you get a situation where, like Krishna, he was speaking to Arjuna, who was practically the crown prince of the whole world. He was the ruler. He was like the emperor of the entire world of that time. His elder brother was the emperor, and he was the next in line. And he was an incredibly intelligent person. He was well versed in all philosophy and art and music. He was like just one of the, practically the best human being on the whole planet at that time, best person in a very developed culture. And so the discussions that happened between Krishna and him were, by the very nature, who's discussing, were of the most profound kind of lucid type of discussion. So a lot of it depends upon, the guru may have a more capacity, but he can only give us the teachings up to the capacity of his followers to accept it. So our understanding of this particular verse is that that Jesus was a bona fide guru, and he was the means of people of that particular time to reach, but that similarly, now, he taught that the first commandment is love God. That's the thing he has the second. I remember I had a discussion with a priest in India, Catholic priest, and then I was stressing this point, that the first commandment is love God. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught the system how to love God. And he just pushed that aside, and he said, no, but he said, but the second commandment is equal to the first, and he didn't want to hear anything about it. Said, the real way to love God is love man. You should just serve the people. And he was into politics, he was into social work, he was in it, he didn't want to hear anything about directly loving God or personal God, or he just kind of short-circuited that whole instruction, just zoop. So no, but the second is the same as the first, and so, and he just focused on the second. And that's mainly what we're finding in Christianity today, is that a few only are really focusing on God, because there's not so much information about God.
Who said that? Love God, and who said that?
A priest in India. A Catholic priest who visited Mayapur in India, he had a discussion with me. We got a lot of priests come by to our temple because we're like the biggest temple in India in a particular region. And we're open to everyone. So I have all the bishops and the brothers and everyone, they're all like friends that come by, the nuns come by. Mother Teresa, Sister Teresa, she's, her nuns always visit us. So we have an open, so then, you know, this particular one, he was from Kerala. And he was a theologian, he used to write books and things, so we got into a little bit of a discussion. But sometimes in India where they want to fix more on the difference, they don't want to, like here in the West you find actually they're looking for how to join religion, how to, even the Episcopals thinking how to join with the Catholic, how to, there's a little bit of a desire, I don't know, in the South, whether the Baptists or Methodists or everyone, I mean, in general I would say that there's a kind of a trend to try to unify religion in the West, to unify people. Somehow in India everything's politicized, so even religion's a little political. But this particular priest was trying to pick out like the difference, and I was trying to show how there was a unity. Basically what Krishna consciousness is focusing on is the first commandment in that we should develop love of Godhead, and practically word for word what Jesus said is exactly what our whole practice of sadhana bhakti is, or the practice of devotional service, is a systematic way of developing love for God. The problem is that when people don't have much knowledge or understanding about God, it's much easier for them, and even Krishna says in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, he said, only the first thing is if you can simply remember and focus all your love and consciousness on me. He says, if you can't do that, then serve me by a practice, by a regulation. And by regulation, by regulative practice, you'll gradually learn to develop, you'll develop love for me. If you can't do that, then work for me. Do some work, offer some service, like come to the temple, sweep the floor, or come and drop off a box of paper, you know, paper plates or something, or just do some kind of work for God. So if you can't do that, then serve others. Serve other people that need. So by serving others, eventually that will lead you to serve God. So that's already there in the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But there Krishna's kind of spelled it out that the best thing is if you really, like whatever Jesus did, didn't he do it to serve his Father? His intention was to serve God. That's my belief in any case.
So once that's the most important commandment, love God.
Yeah.
And second most, love my neighbor as thyself.
Seems to follow the first. So Krishna says, first you serve me, then he broke it down, okay, you can serve in A, B, C category, complete full service or kind of a regulative service, or at least offer some work, offer some part-time service, and then serve others. That's what I'm saying between the Bible and the Bhagavad Gita. There, he spread it out a little bit, he broke the first commandment into three sections, and the second one is also there. So the same teachings are there. If I just made it a little more explained.
Like I have some deities at home, and I serve them all the time, you know, every day. But they're not in the, they're not installed. Is that still service to, you know, I offer it as to Krishna, whatever I do to form my deity, but they're not in the store. Does it still sound?
Oh, yeah.
It does? It does? I'm asking, does it count for service to Krishna?
You offer your food to a picture or the uninstalled deity.
My deity.
It's all right. Krishna accepts that.
I have a picture of you and a Prabhupada on the side.
There's the different types of deities. And deities in a picture form or in these other forms is also bona fide. The difference is that an installed deity means that we formally, we do many kind of sacrifices and we request Krishna to personally come, remain there permanently. And then we, the devotees, commit themselves to perpetually serve Krishna in the deity form. So then from that moment on, there's the regular offerings and taking care. So it's a very big commitment. So naturally, it's difficult for someone to take that kind of commitment in their house. So it's pretty common that people don't have installed deities in the house. But if they offer the prasadam to Krishna in the form of a picture, or if they have a deity that's uninstalled, they pray to Krishna, bow down, and they offer the prasadam, offering the mantras to the through the Guru Parampara and Krishna. He accepts. Our devotees on Sankirtan, they don't carry the deities with them, they carry pictures and they offer.
Why is it necessary to have deities? Why can't you just imagine, God in whatever form you choose? Instead, why do you have to have an
The point is that God has a particular form. He has a specific form, and so that if we meditate on His eternal form, then that's much more purified. The idea that everything is God is monism, or Sanskrit called Advaitism. And philosophically we find that that's not an accurate philosophy. Founding spiritual masters, they've explained that there's basically two things. There's God and His energies. And everything is one with God, at the same time everything is different. Simultaneously oneness and difference. That once He has expanded Himself into energies, those energies have an eternal existence. They don't cease to exist. At the same time, since they've come from Him, they're not different than Him. But at the same time, they're different. And it's kind of inconceivable how it's possible that everything is simultaneously nothing but God, but at the same time, there is on another level, there is a difference between God directly and His energy. So to give us an understanding, then one example is often cited is like the sun, that the sun and the sunlight are different. You can't think of a sun without sunlight. It's like they're inseparable. But if the sunlight shines through the window and comes in my room, I'll say the sunlight's in my room. I won't say the sun globe is in my room. So obviously the sun globe, if we even got close, we'd be burnt to a crisp. It wouldn't fit in the room anyway. So the connection with the sun is here. But there's like a difference, and at the same time there's a oneness. So in the same way, in one sense you can say, well, God is within this table, He's within my heart, He's within every atom, He's everywhere. At the same time, this table isn't God. All there's an energy of God. So this was exhibited by Prahlad, where he was attacked by his father, who was an atheist, and his father said, you say that God is everywhere. So is God within this column? And then he said, yes. He's everywhere, he's in the column also, of his building. So then he smashed the column of the building and said, all right, I smashed your God, and now I'm going to kill you, let him come and protect you. And then out of the column came the Srinagadev, form of Krishna, and protected Prahlad. So sometimes Krishna reveals that he is present everywhere. He can come out of any atom anywhere, but that's kind of a rare exhibition. That's why we don't just imagine something. That would be idolatry, to just imagine something and start worshipping it. What we take is that there are specific descriptions in the scripture. Even the Bible, it says man is made in the image of God. And in the Vedic art, it shows that the perfect figure is God's figure.
his proportion is completely perfect, and so it gives the proportion, how to make a deity, and it gives so every human being is a little bit off. The proportions are not exactly, you know, right on. But God's proportion is 100%. So all artists, when they study and they get a, you know, diagram that, that God's distance from this finger and this is considered one unit, and then that unit from this finger to the elbow will be two of these. Even human beings is pretty close. Like if you put two of those and then put it here to here, it comes more or less the same, but not exactly. More or less. So they have a whole, you know, it's because we have a whole group of artists that make, we make hundreds of clay models, and then we make plaster, and then even sometimes brass casts from these for different exhibits in Mayapur. And so then they have some of these Vedic texts where it actually shows the proportions that you make the deity of Krishna, what proportions you make the deity of Radha, what proportion you make. So it's like a whole science. And ultimately, even you make a deity, obviously Krishna is going to be much more beautiful than a piece of marble or a piece of stone or a piece of metal. But it gives an opportunity for the devotee. It's explained when we had an installation here, that part of that thing explained that when you just make the statue, that's called a bimba or a reflection. That it's not considered a worshipable deity. It's just like a reflection, like if you looked in a mirror, you saw a reflection. It's like a reflection of Krishna. It's not, but then that bimba or uninstalled deity is first of all purified and then worshipped in different ways to through mantras. It's purified to become ready to request Krishna to come and be present within it. Since he can be present everywhere, he can even, he's in every atom. So especially he can be present personally in a deity which is made according to a description in the scripture. And then once, he won't come if anybody asks him, but if a guru or a Vaishnava, pure Vaishnava request and it's done according to the Vedic system, then he can, out of his own sweet will, he personally becomes present in the deity. Then when you actually start worshipping the deity, the devotees can actually feel that Krishna is present. And we have a deity in Mayapur, a Jagannath deity, is 500 years old. And this deity is very active. And some deities are reciprocate with the devotees very quickly. And others are a little, but this deity is like famous to the extent that, I mean, one time a group of students came to see the deity and, there's no electricity in, at this place at that time, and this was maybe 50 years ago. They had come to see the deity, and there was a little ghee wick, a little like a candle, which had burnt down. But it's, in India, what they do is they take an oil wick, they take a little piece of cotton, make a wick out of it, and put it in a little pan with oil, and they light it. But the oil had run out, so just coming down to a little flicker. So the students came, and then the light went out, and then one of them started saying, "Oh, there's no deity here. This is just some false propaganda." This, that, so made some, just made some, you know, negative, cynical statement, and they walked away. All of a sudden, a big flame just shot out of the ghee wick, and then the pujari was sitting there. Says, "Boys, quickly, can you come back here for a minute?" Then he just, they came back, you know. Said, "Just take a look. You can see Jagannath." And then they're looking. Oh, this deity of Krishna. And they said, "I just noticed that flame," and then they looked and there was no ghee, there's no, you know, just a big flame coming out, and then they, wow, you know, then they started pulling their ears and falling down. "I'm sorry, I'll never doubt you again." And this deity has performed many, like, miracles like that, even, I mean, even some things that you could say coincidence, like, recently there was, we were fixing up the temple, and some boy, some thieves came a night and stole 15 bags of cement. And somehow at the same night, there was another part of the village, there was some incident where someone got knifed or something. And so the police were called. They made a raid and were searching house to house looking for the person that was accused of knifing. It just so happened that the police, there was a Mohammedan that did the attack, and the policeman was a Mohammedan. And he came across 15 bags of cement in his house, and then looking for the other thief. So then he said, and he could understand that you stole this from Jagannath. And so then this He felt you're a disgrace to our religion because you're stealing from the temple and everything. In India, they have kind of an instant justice. They don't have like exactly the same system, you know. Kind of, you tied him up or something and from his legs and worked him over with a stick or something and tell him, you know, confessed everything. It's like, they don't have exactly the same. But later on, then that after he got released and everything, that like, person came back to Jagannath and said, please forgive me, I'll never steal anything again. He comes every month now and gives a liter of milk. There's all kind of, I go on, Jagannath has like unlimited pastimes. But many deities have got, every deity has his own different pastimes, and sometimes devotees, some are more frequent than others, but or they react in different ways. But even here in this temple, these deities have very special pastimes. Where Prabhupada came here and he was crying before these deities and said, Nitya Gaurachanda have come here to the Western world. They're giving their mercy. And the devotees, whenever they chant before the deities, they really feel a lot of... Anyone who comes to this temple, even from visiting from other temples, they really come and how here they feel so much happiness in chanting before these deities. That they give a lot of kind of loving mercy to the devotees. So that said that although Krishna is one, and you can say that so every installed deity of Krishna is not different, but they have a lila vaichitra. Lila means pastimes and vaichitra means variegatedness. They have a variegated pastime. So in India you have some temples which are known as, there's one temple called Kirchir Gopina, where the deity stole a pot. He was offered nine pots of condensed milk, and he stole one pot of condensed milk and put it behind his cloth. When the pujari wasn't looking, and then in the dream he told the pujari that I want you to give that pot to a great devotee who's waiting and who's outside.